Greetings again. This is Casey Luskin with ID the Future. We have on the show with us Dr. Frank Tipler, who's going to continue our conversation about fine-tuning of the universe, the multiverse, and the evidence for cosmic design. You mentioned the entropy that's in the universe. Is this related to this really astounding fine-tuning parameter that I've heard of, that the initial entropy of the universe was finely tuned to in one part in, I think it's 1 in 10 raised to the 10 to 123rd power, which is really just a mind-bogglingly small number in terms of how finely tuned the initial entropy has to be. Is this related to that you're talking about right now?
It's essentially the same argument. What you're talking about, 10 raised to the 10 to the 123, I call it the Penrose number.
Yes.
Because Roger Penrose was the first to compute it. What he did is use what is called the Bekenstein bound, which is, you can think of it as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, made fully relativistic and thrown in the language of information theory. That's the number of possible universes that could exist given the size of the universe now. But use the same argument. Bekenstein himself did this decades ago. Go backwards into time. Universe is getting smaller and smaller. The Bekenstein bound restricts the number of states so that rather than having 10 to the 10 to the 123, which is the number of possible states allowed in a universe which is a sphere of greater than 10 billion light years, you're down to the Planck size, 10 to the minus 23 centimeters, quite a little smaller. You're allowed only one possibility. Now, one possible state, remember the entropy is proportional to the logarithm of the number of possible states. Logarithm of 1 is 0. So the initial entropy has to be 0. That's what Bekenstein computed. I think Bekenstein got it right. It forces the universe to have 0 entropy, and incidentally, shows that the temperature on one side of the universe has to be exactly the same as the other side of the universe. Actually, initially, the temperature has to be 0, because if you have radiation with 0 entropy, initial temperature is 0. That's what has to be the starting condition of the universe. It comes from the physical laws themselves. So the physical laws, as set up by the initial singularity, have to say that the universe had to start at 0 entropy and then expands to give rise to the structure we see out there, in particular to intelligent life. Now we look at the universe now. As far as we can tell, we are the only living planet. We've not seen any others, certainly as far as we can tell. The planets of our own solar system are dead. They may have one-cell organisms living on them. I rather think they probably do, those one-cell organisms, and the one-cell organisms are our own planet initially, were they essentially the same one-cell organism. Possible. But I don't. We know there are no intelligent life on the other planets of our solar system. People thought that in the 19th century. They thought Mars was inhabited. We know it's not. There's no intelligent life out there on Mars, as far as we can tell, the other planets. We also have not seen out in our own galaxy any indication of large-scale, planetary-scale, stellar-scale engineering by other intelligent life forms. I conclude that they indicate that we are essentially alone in our own galaxy. So, this being the case, we are unique in our own galaxy. But I've argued that it's inevitable that an intelligent life form will exist in the universe because we are going to be essential in the final state of the universe. We are part of the reality that's making sure that laws of physics are consistent. Second law would be violated by the Bekenstein bound unless there were intelligent life operating on a gigantic scale, universal scale, near the final singularity. I conclude we were brought into existence precisely to ensure that does not happen.
Well, ID the Future listeners, if this doesn't give you something to think about, I don't know what will. These are fascinating ideas, Dr. Tipler. I'd like to just...
What is remarkable about them? They shouldn't be fascinating because they're just automatic consequences of the laws of physics. And it's remarkable to me the extent to which physicists will not accept the consequences of their own equations. typical example in history, because we know how long it took before the consequences were realized. I mentioned when Maxwell wrote down his equations, he deduced the existence of an electromagnetic wave, which was quickly confirmed. No one noticed at the time, it should have been noticed, that consequence of the Maxwell equations is that the speed of this electromagnetic wave would necessarily be the same for all observers. It would have to be a universal constant. That's what the Maxwell equations said. But it wasn't until Lorentz and Einstein, 1904-1905, that the full consequences of that obvious mathematical consequence was realized. 30 years. So sometimes it will take longer. It may take, in the case of Hamel and Jacobi, a century before physicists accept the consequences of their own equations. Hamel and Jacobi equation is a multiverse equation. It says the universes are not unique. They form collectively a multiverse. This was not realized for over a century, 1957, after Hamel and Jacobi wrote down their equation. It should have been realized immediately. Eventually, physicists come to accept the consequences of the equations, which they themselves teach their own students, but don't believe themselves. I wish it occurred faster. Unfortunately, it occurs slower. As I've said, everything I have said to you today is just a mathematical consequence of these equations that are taught to all students. Only difference for me and my colleagues, I believe the equations.
Maybe I could ask you a question about another physicist who I think you probably will say is not accepting all the full consequences of the equations. But obviously, many of our listeners were aware of Stephen Hawking, who wrote in his recent book, The Grand Design, that the universe was self-creating. I'm just curious in your take, and if you could speak to those arguments and those ideas.
Well, Steve is a perfect example. He is a very competent mathematician. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. And he is, in his technical writings, explicit about the weaknesses of his argument. He said, after deducing the existence of the initial singularity, he wrote a book, Large Scale Structure of Space-Time, in which he proved that the initial singularity has to exist. He said, we shouldn't take these theorems seriously, because undoubtedly the singularity will disappear when we quantize relativity. Now, I have a paper out in which I prove that quantization makes the existence of the singularity even more inevitable than in the classical mechanics. Remember, we saw determinism really wasn't there in classical mechanics unless you impose it on classical mechanics. When you did, it's quantum mechanics. Since quantum mechanics is right, it tells us that the universe is deterministic. So we conclude that the singularity has to exist out there. And when Steve, using a non-standard method, hoping to eliminate these embarrassing singularity, cooked up a different way of quantizing relativity, alas, alack, the singularity was still there. He tried to eliminate it. He did, in a sense, he eliminated the initial and final singularity, but only at the price of pushing it somewhere else. He didn't eliminate the singularity. So I say, let's accept the existence of the initial and final singularity and see what it can do for us. Lo and behold, we see that it can eliminate some singularities from physics. It's been known for 50 years that, taken literally, the consequences of quantum theory, say singularities are everywhere. Everything is singular. Everything is infinite. Obvious nonsense. Obviously, I'm speaking finite number of words. You aren't singular. You're nice and finite. I'm not singular. I'm nice and finite. Obviously, these singularities don't exist. What I've shown is you can absorb the equations of physics if you look at them right. You can eliminate these singularities and transfer them to the initial and final singularities. Where they could exist, the equations say they do, let's accept the existence of those singularities, and we find we have a nice and consistent physics when we do so.
Thank you, Dr. Tipler. It looks like we're running out of time for this podcast, so join us for more with Dr. Frank Tipler. This is Casey Luskin for ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is Copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.